بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، الرحمن الرحيم، مالك يوم الدين، إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين، اهدنا الصراط المستقيم، صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين. صدق الله العظيم وصلى سيدنا محمد وآل محمد. فاعلم أنه الله 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 هاي الله هو الله 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 يا الله الله هو الله الله حي الله حي هو الله الله حي الله الله نور الله الله غفور الله الله لا مجبور الله الله يا الله يا نور الله الله هو 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 Alhamdulillah. Thank you, everyone, for coming up here, ascending the stairs. Some of you twice. Very nice to see you all. I was thinking perhaps we should just do 2 hours of zikr instead of talking about zikr. But my dear friend Pierre Llewellyn asked me couple years ago, actually, in addition to chanting the zikr this evening, I should say a few words about it. Everybody hearing me? I'm having a little throat stuff today, so tell me if I... Can you hear me, Aftab? Good. Alhamdulillah. Good. You can sit up here if you want to. My dear friend, thank you so much for coming. Since those who know better than I do, I should like to quote a little bit of poetry. Perhaps amplifying the subject of death and love this morning, this came to my mind. Such is love. If you do not die, you will derive nothing from it. So decide on death, or leave my love alone. Such is love. If you do not die, you will derive nothing from it. So decide on death, or leave my love alone. This is the longest love poem in the Arabic language, the Taiya Kubra, by a 12th century mystic, Omar Al-Farid, qadas Allah, who wrote it in a state of ecstasy. It is quite lengthy, but it's a love poem. And it's sort of like he said, she said, that kind of love poem. And I guess the radical thing that I liked about this is that God is a she. Is that English? God is a she? Yeah. Hiya. And she says, you know, kind of scolding him, if you really want to love me, you must die first. And that's an extremely powerful statement that was set up this morning very well. And it just came to me. The song of love, the wine of love, is dhikrullah. Sufis make a big thing of this. And over the years, I've learned a little bit from those who know. So I'd like to pass some of this wisdom to you from them. Let's start with Shah Naqshband, Qadasallah. That seems appropriate at a Naqshbandi gathering. Where others' remembrance of God ends, our remembrance of God begins. On the path of others, where their remembrance ends, that's where our path begins. And that is about modes of remembrance, of which there must be many, many modes of remembrance. They call the first part of the path dhikr lisan, or dhikr lisani in Farsi. It means the remembrance of the tongue. And then the dhikr al-qalb is another kind of dhikr, means generally speaking, dhikr of the heart. You remember Allah with your tongue, vocal, or you can remember Allah in your heart. And in the Persian language, khushdardam, a very New Age sounding phrase, attention to the breath. It's from like, you know, the 800s in northern Iran. So this was in the Sufi manual by 800 or 900. And this should be familiar to some of you one way or another, the way of the tongue and the way of the heart. There is a wisdom, a proverb, rather, that Sufism is nothing but adab. This word adab is extremely important in the path. It's emphasized. And like all these words, they're untranslatable. But one of the meanings is refinement. We call it latif or latifa. It's a kind of refinement. So the majority of Sufis are attracted to the most vocal, musical, sort of ostentatious, if you will, form of dhikr. And this is as it should be, because most people are in the society are attracted to this form of remembrance one way or another, whether they're remembering one beloved or another. But the more refined parts of dhikr seem to be quieter or latif, subtler, I guess you could say. Atlaf, subtler. And as one goes on the path, you know, the waters run a little deeper. And one remembers the beloved with the hand. There's the dhikr of the hand. One remembers the beloved with a foot. There's the dhikr of the foot, called nazar dar qadam in Persian language. It means sort of concentrating or gazing at the foot. So many ways to remember Allah. So many ways. Dhikr of the hand might be charity to the poor. You remember Allah by giving charity. Not because you think the guy will spend it on liquor, you know. Because you're doing it to remember Allah. It's an more internal and subtler way of giving. And dhikr of the heart, and dhikr of the breath, and then dhikr of the heart is considered the most refined and subtle path of dhikr. It is also an elitist activity. I use that word advisedly. Very, very few people, of all the people in the world who do some form of dhikr or another, can actually sustain this path. It is considered to be the most difficult of all the paths, and sort of the end of all paths, if you will. It takes intense training. For Americans, this is tough, but it takes years of intense training. I once tried to run a fast workshop because I never thought I'd have to teach again. Well, that's my nafs, but it just doesn't work, you know? It's very subtle, very incremental, and it is much like an art form. It's learning to play a Stradivarius violin, a cantata or so. It's a very, very disciplined and rigorous, let's say, path. I compare it to the Zen Buddhism of the Sufis. You know, it's the most subtle and quiet. And I think those who are involved, I've noticed, you know, at big dhikrs and big tents with big drums, I notice that those who are involved also in the path of the heart, the silent dhikr, they sort of have something in common. It's odd, you know. Of course, we never speak of it because we're silent, you know. That's part of the game, but it is. It's called a dhauk, a tasting of the presence in someone that does this deep, deep work. And as I say, they're really few and far between. And now, if that elitist activity is very difficult to do, I mean, there's several ways of doing it. You can start with a vocal dhikr and then do dhikr, work up the way up the path, and then finally get up to the silent dhikr. That's one way the tariqa do it. The other way is just to start with silent dhikr, because it's so difficult to get it that you have to begin early and keep at it like that. Khushdardam, concentration on the breath, or dhikr of the... I've seen the dhikr of the pulse, too. Actually, two sheikhs showed me dhikr of the pulse. I couldn't find my pulse, so that didn't work too well. But there is such a thing. Even the pulse is something by which you remember the beloved. It's a fantastically diverse and sort of cornucopia collection of practices. And one of these paths, whichever one you're on, has its own ahkam, rules and regulations and ways of guidance. This is normal. However, after years of pursuing the path, a few of those become what they're called the Khajagan. I'm sure you've heard of this. It's a Persian plural. Masters of wisdom, more or less. Khaje. They become masters of every level of vicar, actually. Very few people can do this. Vicar of the heart are trained. Vicar of the tongue, they're trained. Vicar of the hand and foot, etc., etc. The eyes, vicar of the eyes. Tefekur, many, many ways. Vicar of the heart, and all the ways. Call the Khajagan. And I thought I'd give you, as I've been asked to do, some insight into that way of vicar, kind of the all and everything vicar, but as one would have it, one can train carefully. It turns out that the vocal vicar and the silent vicar are not quite what they appear to be to beginners. And it runs something like this. Because of the physicality of audition, one pays attention to sound, yes? And I don't know if this is true of opera singers and Quran reciters, but one learns to pay an equal amount of attention on the silence after a while, which is between the sounds. So in the beginning, it appears to be a series of notes, so forth and so on. But as one begins to excel in the esoteric science, at least, one begins to pay an equal amount of attention to the quality of the silence or the silences which occur between the sound segments. And that is a full-on or the deepest kind of concentration that has to be well learned in two parts and then integrated like that. Also, the silent vicar is not quite what it appears to be after years of concentration on the silent vicar. And it goes something like this. In the silent zikr, I don't know if this only happens to me, but I get distracted sometimes. Once in a while I get distracted. If I'm sitting in zikr, and I hear a sudden noise, you know, I'll jump or so. And then certain thought forms are subsequent to that explosion or siren or something. Things happen when you're the father of four daughters. They happen in sound explosions many times. Like that. Well, that proves in the beginning to be a distraction from your pure, silent, sort of formless concentration. Yes? However, there is a way to, shall we say, manage those moments of distraction in a more sophisticated manner. And that's a great art. That's a great, that's a mastery that one understands. And it's something like this. In the beginning, you are the meditator doing meditation for half an hour, an hour or something, 5 hours, whatever it is. And you experience some moments of bliss or boredom or something like this. And you hear these noises, like static, you know, or explosions, with a physical ear. And you think, as the subject of your universe, you think thoughts. And these thoughts are distracting. And you think them with your individual mind, your personal mind. My advice is to stick with it. Because a transformation begins to occur if you're lucky and you have the right training. A transformation begins to occur in the subject, you. And this is the promise of God. In the Hadith al-Qudsi, sacred tradition, it says, I become the eye by which you see. I become the ear by which you hear. I become the hand by which you grasp. And I become the foot with which you walk. You see? So in the beginning, you need to keep your eyes closed. Like this. Actually, the Greek mystica, when you get mystic, means to close the eyes. Isn't that interesting? But Sufis think this is good for beginners. Until the eye of the heart opens, and you really do see the world in a new way, called khalq jadid, a new creation. It can happen in an instant, it can happen gradually, it can come with age. The eye of the heart opens. And when you look out upon the world that was full of distractions from your silent meditation before, you see by the light of Allah, you see by the light of God like that, you will see a new creation. The ear of the heart opens. Hamakallah. The ear of the heart opens. And those distractions that used to cause some kind of interruption, you still hear it with a physical ear, you know. You don't have to go deaf and blind to do this. It's difficult, but not that bad. You still hear it, but you also hear with the ear of the heart, the eye of the heart, like that. Opening. And then it is God who becomes the ear by which you hear. God becomes the eye by which you see. So you can have your eyes open. Your physical eyes open. Eye of the heart. Basira is the eye of the heart. You can have your ears open. You don't have to wear ear plugs like I try to do when I try to sleep. It doesn't work. But ear plugs, no. Still having ears open, but ear of the heart is open. And even Farid Qadasullah goes into great, great depth in the longest love poem about the eye of the heart and the ear of the heart. It's plain, he says. It's mubin. It means it's plain, it's evident what this means. But what does it mean to the lover who's remembering God? Complete freedom. Mutlak. It's complete freedom. Sitting in quiet room, remembering Allah. Sitting in noisy supermarket, remembering Allah. Remember, you're hearing with an ear, which is God, like that. So in the beginning, the difficulties that you encounter on the silent path, not difficulties. Welcoming. Limitless. No restriction. That place where you go with that dhikr, in Persian language is called Hichistan. Hich means nothing. Some people are Afghanistan or Balochistan. The Sufis are Hichistan. I'm going to get a passport. They can take my picture like this. Very nice in airport lineups. It says, Imam Bilal, Hichistani. What country do you come from? Hichistan means no place. Hichistan is a great place. It's a place of unlimited freedom. The infinite is there and nothing else. Remember, it's the infinite that's speaking. I become your eye by which you see. Any restrictions there? Anything of hidden worlds? Anything about sacred and secular? You see? Down and up, up and down, good and bad. Hichistan. That's where Rumi says there is a field, you know, I'll meet you there. Actually, that field has a name, Hichistan. All the Hichistanis are there too. Or maybe they're not there. Whoops. Now that I think of it. It'd be great. I wonder what the coat of arms would be like for Hichistan. I don't know. You're a citizen of the world, but at the same time, inwardly, Hichistani. I'm from a place called Albany, and after the Kosovo wars, we call ourselves Albanians. Everybody wants to be from somewhere. Well, Hichistan is a good place because we're all from Allah. Anyone not from Allah? Any exceptions? My best friend in Berkeley is a rabbi, as a matter of fact. And he has this talk he gives, do Republicans have souls? It's Berkeley. It's a question, you know? You ask yourself, I'm probably going to get in trouble for this. No, Mr. Bush, I was not a twin. No, I won't do that. So, anyone not from Allah? Not from Allah? Any exceptions? I can't see you. All returning to Allah. You see? So we're all from Hichistan. And the great return, Raja, the great return is to Allah. I'll meet you there. I'll meet you there. In a place beyond all divisions, all separation ends in Hichistan. And the only thing we can say about it is Ishqallah. That's all. Ishqallah. Mahabbat in Persian language. Ishqallah. 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 That's all we can say. in that place is I love you. That's it. Nothing else to say. Each As it turns out, since I'm a linguist, I looked the word Allah up in the dictionary. Just something to do. Well, what does Allah mean? It's a good place. It turns out that like all Semitic languages, Hebrew and Babylonian, Akkadian, and so on, Arabic has three letters called a root, waliha, and it's a verb in these languages. It's to God, or godding, or however you say that. So what is the root of this word Allah that's now in Hebrew and so on and so forth? Actually, the verb to Allah, however you say that, to God, or godding, it includes two concepts, two great areas of meaning that don't always go together in English, but just bear with me. If you want to understand the meaning of the word Allah, there's two concepts. Madness and passion. Insanity and love. Going crazy and infatuation. It's not just love, it's crazy love. It's insane love. It's nuts. And it's love. So when you say the word Allah, you might think G-O-D, up to you, or dear, or God. But the actual word means, and I got this from the dictionary, to go topsy-turvy. Isn't that great? With yearning and passion and longing and desire. That's what Allah means. And if you can keep these two concepts kind of suspended at the same time, it's not too hard to do if you've ever been 13 or 14 and really crazy, irresponsibly in love like that. No defenses, you know, no deep wounds, no hurt, no rejection. Just kind of innocent passion. Remember what that was like? So great. So painful, yet so deep. From the very core of your being, something is touched and reaches out with everything. How much do you have to give for love? Everything. No restrictions. Limitless. The passion runs deep, 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 and never ever lets you go. Not for Sufis. Remember that? Hunger means nothing. You forget to eat because you're so in love. Sleep, there's a good one when you're in love. Tears on my pillow. Oh, wrong workshop, sorry.
That's next week. Like that. Sleep. Concentration on the world, usually high school. I used to teach college, you know, freshmen. I knew what they were thinking about. I taught theology and theoretical grammar, yuck. One of the classes was at 8 o'clock, and those who were awake were not thinking about theoretical grammar. I'm gonna tell you something. They had passion, like real passion. You know, you sort of fall in love with somebody, but it's really falling in love with the world. That's what it's like. It's that first infatuation. That's exactly what the word Allah means. So does Ishq, by the way. They kind of invented a new term because people began to think very quickly that Allah means God, you know. The law boys got it in there. The god of war, the god of commerce, and so on. So they made it into their own image, but that's not what was happening. If you just look at the language, the dictionary, you get back to what it really, really means. You see? So the Sufis are right. Mejnun and Layla says it all, doesn't it? Shireen and Farhad, Romeo and Juliet. They were teenagers, come to think of it, too. On the Middle East, they were about 8 or 9. Things happen faster there. But that's how you become. You become like so childlike in your relationship to Allah. And now you know what I mean by Allah. That all perfection, all delight, all sweetness, all beauty comes from Allah and Allah alone. You just fall in love. But unlike human love, I don't know if any of you have been disappointed in love, but hey, I have my own story, you know. I wasn't born with this turban on, by the way. You know, I was a surfer in L.A. We had love. Surfer love. I better not talk about that. My wife told me not to talk about food or sex when I talk about Sufism. Do not use those examples. We're tired of those jokes. I think they're very funny. See, I'm starting to laugh already. Bad form to laugh at your own jokes, but there we go. Where was I? Oh. Right. Unlike human love, you stay in love. You stay in love. You fall in love, but you never fall out of love. That's what Ishqala means. It never stops. It's endless. It's eternal. It really does what it's supposed to do. It transcends both space and time. It's forever. Like marriages in Brazil. Oh, I'm not supposed to say that. There's no divorce laws in Brazil, so it's forever. But this is beyond death, beyond life, beyond death, beyond time, beyond space, beyond heaven, hell, the afterlife, angels. It's beyond your idea of eternity. It's beyond your idea of the infinite. It is so permanent that you actually cannot think about it because your mind is not made that way. You actually do not have a concept. It is not possible for the mind, unless you're thinking with the mind of God at the moment. You do not have the intellectual equipment, or no human being has this, to even conceive of what endlessness is, because it is totally beyond experience. It is totally beyond our experience. And it's one of my favorite subjects. And as my daughter tells me, you know, you talk forever about the infinite. Well, that's kind of the idea of it. It's breakfast and they have to go to school, so there you go. So what is that love? Well, it turns out that what has no end, endlessness, has no beginning. It is also beginningless. There's very handy terms for this in Arabic, called azali and abadi. Abadi, azali. Time before time, time after time, beginningless, endless. Allah, azaliya is the name of God. It means the beginningless. And abadiya means the endless. That's the kind of love. That's what ishq Allah. It is actually infinite. No boundary, no limit, infinite. The verse in the Quran says, He loves them and they love him. The beloved loves the lovers. And the lovers love the beloved. A commentary on this is, you love God when you think God is something. A beloved, naturally you love the beloved. If you think God is nature, you love nature. If you think God is everything, you love everything. Like that. Sacred tradition says, I am as my servant imagines me to be. The infinite is no problem to take any form, even finite. If you see God in a tree, you love the tree. That's it. You love God because you think God is something. God loves you when you are nothing. Before you were created, that infinite love loved you. Before you were something, God loved you. That's infinite, absolute, and unqualified love that transcends time and space. It just doesn't end. I asked a sheikh what Al-Wadud means, Ya-Wadud. It's one of the 99 names of God, O love. He said it's a kind of love that never changes. Never dies. It never fades. It never changes. But if it does change, it gets stronger. That's like a long, good, solid marriage, actually. That's what it's like. As you age, that love, which was shaky in the beginning, doesn't fade. It only grows stronger until you die. But this love goes beyond death, yeah? Beyond life, beyond time, beyond space. You love God if you love God because you think God is something generous or kind or compassionate. But God loved you in a time before time when you were nothing, before creation, before time, before space, were dimensions in the universe. This is infinite love. This is what we call the wine of love. The wine of love. Once you're intoxicated with this love, you never sober up. It's permanent, called makam. And how is it that you never fall out of love? Because when the eye of the heart opens and the ear opens, you see nothing but Allah, illallah. And now you know what I mean by Allah. You hear nothing but Allah. They said what Al-Jalaluddin Rumi, Qaddasallah, whose birthday, not death day, but birthday was a few days ago. We celebrated it in North Carolina. He said he did a retreat to open his heart. And when he got out of the retreat, in the sunlight, the birds, instead of saying tweet, tweet, or whatever that is in Persian, said Allah, Allah. And the cheese seller, instead of saying paneer, paneer, buy your paneer here, whatever that is in Persian, they said Allah, Allah. That's all he heard. He didn't hear paneer or tweet or the rustling of the leaves outside or the air conditioning in this room rushing through the vents. Yeah, that's what happens to your awareness. You start to hear stuff. Be careful. Be careful. It opens you up. You see things that you cannot now imagine. You hear Allah. And it sounds like love. Complete, absolute, endless, timeless love. That's why it's called the way of the brokenhearted lovers. You cannot be whole. You cannot have a solid, whole, healthy life. They call the murshid, the spiritual guide, Tabib al-Qulub. It means physician of the hearts. You see, when somebody says they want to come and see me, I say, how you doing? Be careful, it's a trick question. If they say fine, that's bad news for the visit. How you doing? Fine. If you're fine, you don't need this path. This is for broken-hearted lovers. Cynical, disappointed, depressed. What time is it? Now I better finish this lecture quick, huh? A few jokes would probably be good. You must be a broken-hearted lover. The path described by Rumi this morning is Rahib Purkhun, Persian language. It means a path that's full of blood. You must be broken. You must be broken. And then the eye of the heart opens, and it's nothing but love. Love we all come from. Love we return. That's the path. It's a circle. It's a circle. Now, sometimes I get practical and I ask myself, well, that sounds okay, I guess. How do we start? Got to start somewhere. How do we open the heart? How do we open the eye of the heart? How do we open the ear of the heart? How do we do that, you know? Well, it turns out it doesn't happen by some kind of magic formula. That's called popular Sufism. Popular Sufism has a lot of magical formulas. And my teacher used to say, you know, Bilal, there's a very thin line between superstition and religion. I said, yeah, I've noticed that. I was educated in East Africa. The way to open the heart is through dhikrullah. Dhikrullah is the method to open the heart for some of us, very, very slowly, gentle procedure. The hadith says that the tradition is that every rust has a polish. The polish of the heart is dhikrullah. Dhikrullah, silent dhikr, vocal dhikr, but some dhikr that is at least a repetition of something that'll actually work. You know, you want this to work. Otherwise, you're sort of going down a dead end. So that's what's so important. Dhikrullah, dhikrullah, dhikrullah. Make your heart a dhikr, hand a dhikr, tongue a dhikr, thought forms dhikr, whatever. But this is the method by which the Sufi removes the rust of the heart, sort of breaks the covering, or not quite breaks, but I call it the way of the chicken, you know, very gently sort of loosens up that hardness in the heart. Most people, when they relate to each other, especially in this society, are like this, you know, it's called the nafs. It's really well built because you don't want anybody to peep inside your heart because it's soft, broken. This. I like you, but I'm not going to let you in because you might hurt me. Like this. What the British call American pseudo-toughness. Like cowboy stuff. It's a pseudo-toughness. Like this. I'm businesslike. I'm efficient. I constructed my ego. Took a long time and a lot of trouble. Don't look in. Don't hurt me. It's a shield, you know. I have to be always right. I have to know more than anybody else. I have to be stronger, better. This is it. Hire me. Job interviews are the best. I just should have 8 hours of job interviews. That's kind of torture, but it is. It is perfect. You know, you construct an ego and you take it to the market and sell it like this. That's called a kufran, a covering over the heart. Very well constructed. We got it all down. You see, you appear to be tough, cynical, knowledgeable, strong, when, you know, inside, you know, you're none of these things. You've got it down. Nobody's going to come in here. I'm tough. Don't hurt me. What does the dhikr do? Starts to relax. Relax. Just a little bit scary, I know. Relax. A little bit. Watch out who you put your heart into their hands. Your heart is a very, very precious thing. You don't get another one later. If you put your heart into the hands of a guide, be very, very careful. But when you start to relax slowly, 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 the fear, you know, that deep fear of getting hurt again after you swore, I'm never going to get hurt again like this. I swear to God. God's listening. Start to relax. That fear starts to relax. I know. Hey, I'm an American imam. Guess what? I deal with fearful people all the time. That's my job. Just read this student review I was going to mention at a kind of yoga center or something in San Francisco, CIAS. And they write critiques about you at the end, you know. And this woman signed up for my class, or as we say, made the mistake of signing up for my class. And she kind of introduced herself, like, I'm actually from a farm in Alabama, and my father is a Primitive Baptist preacher, and this is the first time I've ever been to San Francisco. I said, uh-huh. Well, at least he had the guts to come up and talk to me. And she said, and I really don't understand anything you're talking about. Yes, this is great for a teacher, you know, gives you a lot of confidence. So we had a weekend workshop, and we did some whirling and drumming and stuff. She felt better about it. She wrote this critique is like this. She said, this is just one example I'm just thinking of right now. She said, when I walked in your classroom and I first saw you, she said, I tried to keep an open mind. It's one of the best critiques I ever got. You know, she's so innocent from a farm in Alabama, right? So she's probably going to say what she thinks. And she really tried, you know, it was a great deal of effort to keep an open mind. So we had a good time on that one. But I